Okay, so I'm recording, yeah. Hopefully I don't lose this recording. Okay, so what's up everybody? Once again, welcome back to the podcast of Philly and John's World Tour, behind the scene podcast, interviews, whatever you want to call it. John's my coach, if you don't know that by now, all the way from Cape Town. If you haven't been there, you don't know what you're missing out on. So make a trip down to South Africa and go visit the area. John, how are you doing?
Yeah, good and yourself?
Nah, very, very, very chilled, yeah. Racing tomorrow again. Day after tomorrow. Looking forward to a 200-guy bunch sprint.
Easy day. Over by mid-afternoon.
Yeah, and then a long flight back, all the way back home. And yeah, back to training then, now. So just work.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, John, so the World Championships happened. I don't think anyone is really surprised with the winner. How many medals does he have? 15? Alejandro Valverde?
Sure, yeah, at least. I don't know where he stocks all of them, to be honest with you. He must have like a separate accommodation somewhere. With all his medals lined up from years and years of racing,
I think he's got enough to influence the gold market in South Africa. To be honest,
it's not very hard. No, definitely, you could melt it and then retire on them alone. It would be great.
John. So yeah, let's just quickly look about. We saw a lot of favorites that got shelled early on. Mikhail Kwiatkowski, Vincenzo Nibali, Zakarin. There were so many riders that all got shelled. And everyone was quite surprised. And everyone kind of had the idea that I heard a TV commentator say, yeah, it's impossible to maintain your form so long without doing Vuelta. And I don't think that's the truth.
Like typically guys had done, you know, if you look at history of worlds, like guys had gone to Vuelta, not necessarily done all 3 weeks, but definitely had done sort of like a week and a half or something like that, pulled out and gone to worlds and had done well, possibly even won. But when you look at, you know, guys like Nibali, who had done, you know, two tours, you know, back to back, and stuff like that, or like the super domestics. Yeah, none of them, not saying none of them, but like even Dan Martin, you know, they battle. So to carry form that long, or to hit sort of 2-3 peaks, which is sort of physiologically only possible in a season, it's hard. You know, unless Worlds is a massive goal, which I'm sure it is important for all of them, but, you know, when you look at some of the guys who have who were shelled, although that sounds pretty savage.
Yeah.
But yeah, the guys that sort of were shelled, if you look at how long their season were and where they were performing in the early part of the year and also in the late part, like I'm not surprised at all. Simple as that. No matter how good they are. You know, Dan Martin, theoretically that course is built for him as a 1 day race. And unfortunately, yeah, he was out the back, eh?
Yeah, and obviously now I'm going to quickly mention this, is that, you know, you have to be very disciplined after Vuelta going into Worlds. So after you've done all that preparation, and if you have, and Vuelta was a very big goal for you, you have to, after that 3 weeks of hard racing, you have to stay focused. How long more? How long after Vuelta is Worlds?
It was what, like... Four weeks, I think, if I'm correct. I don't know the exact date, but it's still it's a long time.
Yeah. So they
like purely from a mental aspect. Never mind physically. Just mentally, it's tough.
Yeah. And mentally is the most difficult part of this sport is the mental aspect of it for me. You know, if you told me going out every day 5 hours. Will make me win world champs, I'll go do that. But, you know, at the end of the day, mentally, it will become more difficult than physically, to be honest.
Yeah, think about yourself. Like, after you've done some pretty big blocks, you know, you're on the phone and you hate me, you hate life, and you simply just fatigued and mentally it's tough. You know, when you look at your stuff and you send me that message, like, do I have to do this today? Like, yes, go ride your bike. It's your job.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough. So imagine doing possibly two back-to-back grand tours. So after the one grand tour, you need to be fully focused to the next grand tour. Go there and then again, keep focused straight into Worlds. It's like, it's tough, right?
So, basically what I'm thinking now is that, so they've been focused, like let's say 3 months, minimum of 3 months before Vuelta, they've been focused, and that's to say if they haven't come out of the Tour de France. And they've been focused for so long, now they have to stay focused, and what I mean by this is sleep early, keep the weight down, focus on, you know, the hard work, not spending that much time with the family, not hanging out, not drinking. Remember, we're all only human. And then, yeah, they need to maintain that for another 4 weeks and keep peak form while being completely destroyed. Yeah, so, yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Doing a grand tour like we've seen with Van Avermaet now, that or guys like that, they you don't necessarily have to do Vuelta to have good form for world champs.
Yeah, definitely not. Although history has a, like we said, sort of like does sort of lean that way or predict it, but yeah, you don't have to anymore. Or I don't believe it's a requisite for it.
Yeah. But okay.
But again, like 2 weeks at the Vuelta can't hurt like a training load. Like, you know, you'll definitely come out of it good and then recover and taper to Worlds.
It's really good you mentioned that now, because I've actually have a question myself here then. Well, if you enter Vuelta with not very good form, that it your body might not be able to handle the load sometimes, and you actually get worse going through the 3 weeks opposed to building form.
Yeah, definitely. It would just be how you sort of react to it. It might be too much too late. And you have like a negative effect from it. But again, it, you know, you sometimes if you do have bad form and you just go anyway and you just hope for the best, and like often, you know, at your level and at that sort of level, is a lot of the time once guys do get load in them, your form does come back pretty quick. It's sort of par for the course, but you know, again, it depends where you started off, and it can work against you at the end of the day.
John, so then another thing, obviously training wise, then is if to explain a little bit to the people there, is that, well, in as short as possible, is that your training for, and this is quite crucial, training for a tour opposed to a 1 day event, your training can differ quite a lot completely, the periodization, everything you do. Or is there some aspects that stay the same, or does it differ quite a lot? Because I know with our training, it does in a way, but it depends if that's a A race, a B race, and it really gets complicated.
Yeah, it would. Obviously, a tour being 3 weeks and a classical Worlds is 1 day. So, you know, it won't change completely different, you know, in terms of sort of how it's structured or how it's periodized. But it would sort of be tailored a bit more specifically to what you're going to go and do. You know, for argument's sake, if you take, you know, now, like the block you've done now for Lombardia and stuff like that, and also potentially as we were going to Worlds and sort of what your plan was going into Worlds, if you had gone, was, you know, we had sort of trained a little bit specifically for that, you know, as opposed to what we did when you were going into Tour of Switzerland. So, yes, it does change. Not night and day change. It's probably like a, you know, what if you take a percentage, you know, maybe there's like a 20% difference, 15% difference of what you do in specifics. But, you know, it's not going to be like two completely different things.
So it makes sense because I'm actually looking on my Twitter now, and in regards with this, I see actually Joe Friel. I like following some of his tweets, but the problem I have with his tweets is that it's really, he leaves it up to you to interpret what he has said. So one guy might see it as one thing and one other guy might interpret it as something completely different, because it all depends who you are as an athlete. And why I say this is, for example, yeah, he says training, he answers someone's questions, yeah, and he says training peaks PMC, I allow for individualization based on experience by aiming for a race day TSB form between plus 5 and plus 25. So my question, yeah, is with the professional, with the professional riders in the peloton, not all of them aim to be plus 5, plus 25. Some of them are minus 10 and go well. Some minus 15. Some are completely broken and go well. There isn't really a formula here. I have to argue with this.
Sure, if you look on a chart, like plus 5 to 25 is a huge range.
Yeah.
Typically you would go plus 25 would be way too fresh. And plus 5 would be okay.
Yeah.
But again, it's, you know, where people look at that sort of PMC in terms of, you know, where they say it's individualization, is that there's so many other factors or variables that play a part. You know, like all training peaks are PMC, which I use, so it's a great tool, but that alone only tells me what the files tell me. It doesn't tell me what you as an athlete told me. So, you know, perfect example, as you said, you know, you could be on negative 10, say 120 and negative 10 going into Tour of Switzerland, and you tell me, like, I'm absolutely flying, like, feel amazing, it's great. But on paper, that should mean, you know, you're carrying some significant fatigue and you really shouldn't actually be going so well.
Yeah.
I do agree with him on the individualization. It is purely based off you as an athlete, but there where your catch comes in is that you need to know where on that PMC chart you are good as a person.
Mm.
But as I said, like plus 25 is big, even if that is individualization. No,
if I pitch up at plus 25, that's a feeling I get when you taste the blood in your throat when you do that interval, because that's how fresh I'll be.
Super fresh. Yeah. Yeah, we'll definitely get a new max heart rate off that value. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
And then you'll moan at me the minute you get Wi-Fi in the bus, telling me how bad you felt.
Oh shit! No, so yeah, I think that's just whatever coach you're working with or entity, that's really important that the coach understands you. Now we see why, because that coach needs to know. Personally, almost needs to know you as his own cell phone. You know, he needs to know how quick you charge, how full the storage is, all that type of stuff.
Yeah.
Where the buttons
but
are.
But there again, it's you can't just work off a PMC. You need to work off like an external monitoring system, whether that's like a Dalda document or, you know, wellness scores, etc. It's not just looking at a PMC chart and going, hey, I'm good today. You know, it's because that's what I'm plus 5 or plus 25 and X. It's it doesn't work that way.
So this is also what I want to ask in regards with this is sometimes there has to be you kind of have to experiment a little bit. So sometimes you have to give, like, let's say for example you see that I go well into races at a negative TSB, training stress balance, but that wasn't necessarily your plan, but things changed, some extra races came into effect and I'm at negative. So now I'm saying that, is it common for coaches to sometimes experience with the athletes during important races and just hope for the best? Because I guess you sometimes have to.
Sometimes it's too late to make any changes. So, just as an example, the last thing you want to do is, say you had a, it's now coming up to a race on Friday, as an example. And today we see that you on a negative 15, as an example, and it's it's not where we wanted to land up because of whatever reason it was.
Yeah.
You can't then, you know, say to the guy, okay, well, do an hour and a half today, nothing tomorrow, hour and a half on Thursday, Thursday, and then go race on Friday. You know, then you're going from like, say, a 15 or a 20-hour week to a 6-hour week, and then you're going to go ask someone to go race. It's just that that going from such a big load to nothing is worse than going in fatigued. So, you know, if that had to happen, which I'm sure last year did when you were in and out of Spain all the time, is you would try to get recovery in as best as possible, maybe lower the pre-race intensity in terms of numbers, and just instead of, say, going, you know, like 110%, go 100%, or something like that, or change your session maybe from, you know, 40-20s to just threshold 2x5s, just to keep some intensity, but just lower it, so we try to get rid of some fatigue going into the race. But sometimes, you know, if there really is something that really went wrong somewhere along the line, like you get told on Friday you have to go race on Sunday, which is quite common. You know, 100%. Or like, hey, you're going to this tour for 4 days tomorrow. You know, unfortunately, that's like, well, good luck, but we'll fix it when you get back. And that's, it doesn't happen often, but sometimes you just got to go, okay, well, that's where we are. We'll figure it out afterwards.
And then, okay, so, I haven't really, okay. Then one interesting question I actually have is, the other day you gave me some intervals. I think it was 4x4, round about, I think I did 430 watts for each of them. And then finished off with 4x30 seconds, round about 700 watts, plus or minus. So that was just basically a short day, 2.5 hour ride. You know, it's kind of those days since I've upgraded, if I could say that, to this level, those I actually feel like a super easy day, and it feels as if I'm just quickly opening up some of the petrol pipes or something. Whereas that before used to be like a medium day. But now my question with you is like, if you guys don't know by now, John coached Alan, who actually won under 23 world champs cross country, which is absolutely amazing. And obviously my training program and his, I think, differ quite well to a certain extent, because he definitely gets into the gym more than I do.
if he goes once,
more than. But now my question is like, and you've seen this, I've gone through a difficult period after Norway, and it could have been a lot of things, and obviously we think it has been a little bit of the altitude, because it had a massive effect on my hematocrit and hemoglobin. But normally we don't usually look too much at hematocrit, because that varies because of a lot of external factors like heat, cold, where how hard you train, and when they took the blood test. And then your hemoglobin is more constant, like between 14 to 16. And, you know, apparently from what I read and heard from experienced people, that's more your stable value that you should look at when you're worried about your blood count. But anyway, so mine was a bit low, and I went through a bit of a dip, and I did a lot of races, so it can be so many things. But we've seen that in my training, it didn't show. My values was very good between, let's say, 3 and 4 hours. But I would pitch up to a race, and then in the last hour, I would be completely kind of empty. Whereas Alan doesn't necessarily get to 6 hours or 5 hours in his races. Does that mean it's more easy to get his program right in a way or not? Sorry if I offend you with the question. I'm curious.
It's not. Both of you, both of you, when I say you're the same, it's because, you know, both of you are world tour. Like, when I compare numbers and that, you guys are all punching it at that world tour level. You know, it's just, in terms of load differs, you know, both of you are different from physically and physiologically, so your load that you can handle is different to the load he can handle. The intensity is also like Alan eats up high intensity. Like that's what makes him strong. Yeah. Your stuff is built on high intensity, yes, but not sort of at the values and the sessions similar to his, where, you know, yours, as you said, you know, your race after 5 hours is actually when you start racing. When you look at your files and that, it's like, not saying that you sit and do nothing for 4 hours, four and a half hours, but when you need to produce those high values, it's at 5 hours. You know, and it's sort of like once or twice off for a certain period, certain duration, and then again at the end, where, you know, with him doing cross country, it's from the back for an hour and a half. That's it. You know, and it's all out, everything you go. Like, if you had to do, like, if you had to do that, your guys' races would be turned around. So you guys would race in the first hour, hour and a half, and then whoever was left after that would ride to the finish and have a sprint. You know, that's sort of like how your races work, if you look at it in terms of numbers and intensity.
Yeah, I think, flip. It's quite interesting because, and I really don't know, because I actually don't have a lot of friends that do cross country, but now I'm asking you, is we pack in as much food as we can, like bananas, whatever doesn't upset the stomach, and Alan is probably just like 2-3 jars, here I go, with the energy drink.
I don't know, it's not that, like his feeding strategy, which
does he eat a bar like during it,
because he won't eat a bar, it'll be gels and stuff like that, but I don't really want to kind of say what his eating strategy is during a race, just purely
normal.
I know it sounds stupid, but it's his and I don't really want to let that info out, but I'm sure it's similar to everyone during an XC. But he won't eat a solid, like it'll be gels and obviously liquid stuff like that, like some little mixes and stuff, but essentially he wants to keep that spike going for the hour and a half. That's the difference, where yes, you want that spike, but because you're racing 5 hours, you don't want to have a spike like a sugar spike or a caffeine spike and then you have that dip, you know, like that's the last thing you want when it counts. So in terms of what you eat when and during the race is different. Like he's not going to be chowing rice cakes on lap four. Like I can promise you that. anything, he's going to be eating like a liter of gels. But yeah, so it's different, like different sport, different intensity durations. You know, but when you look at numbers, and I say this respectfully, like Alan, you know, he would need to learn the race craft and stuff like that, but. You know, when you look at him on paper, he could go race World Tour tomorrow.
Yeah.
Simple as that. That's how good he is.
Yeah. No. And when you talk about the nutritional aspect of that, I'm not going to mention names. I'm just going to quickly run through it. But I had a friend they're actually testing out some ketone supplementation now. And actually with a guy who's really, 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 really good. One of the best in the world. You can make your own conclusions at cyclocross. Is that he told us that, by using ketones, you know, the only difference he felt without doing any fat adaption stuff or changing his diet, the only difference he felt was that he doesn't eat that much much more carbs. You know, so he doesn't have to eat that much carbs in the race as he used to. And that's actually the only difference he felt. So that was I don't think we should run long on the topic, but that's quite, I think that's making a revolution in revolutionizing cycling. But the ones in the bottles I know are extremely expensive, so not the,
it's big ammo, right?
So I don't know how, like, if you're not really one of the best in the world, I don't know how you even afford that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. But also, like, essentially, if you periodize your nutrition correctly, you know, that's also it's a huge benefit to you going forward.
Yeah.
You know, periodize that with your training, with your racing. You know, that'll already give you a a percentage gain.
I was speaking to our one doctor in the team, really brilliant. Once again, just out of privacy, I'm not going to name his name now. But he actually did a few allergy tests with me and he said, okay, well, you've got these few food sensitivities, nothing serious, but these are your food sensitivities and you should try and stay away from it. And the first question I asked him is, how much would that affect my cycling, you know, on this level? And because, you know, we digest, we put our stomach under a lot of stress with the amount of calories we eat per try and consume per day. He just said that not that big, but he said 1% will make a huge difference on your level. And, you know, so true.
Essentially at that level, your level, Alan, you know, stuff like that, even, you know, Matt Beers, if you look at his result at Marathon Worlds, is that... Yeah.
What know, was he,
35th? Yeah, 32nd and started like 157. So,
wow.
You know, he ripped through it. So, you know, from that side, when you're looking for 2%, you know, people think, oh, it's 2%. But, you know, 2% in cycling or even like 5% is the difference between doing 400, you know, like for argument's sake, 300 or 315 for whatever, an hour. You know, it's like, or even 10 minutes if you want to take it, even as a short duration. And that's like, it's a whole world of hurt. And yet, you know, 5%, you know, people are like, oh, what sort of like gains am I going to make? And you're like, well, you can't really say it. But if you make, you know, 2% or 5% a year for a period like for 3 years, you know, it's a big jump.
Big jump, yeah. Yeah. John, and then I'm sorry, I'm jumping the gun on a lot of the questions because we're almost done here. You posted a Instagram story, guys. If you don't follow John, following him on Instagram, you'll for sure see his dog. Don't say any bad comments about Doug because he will come to your doorstep. But anyway, so we it's an interesting thing that we're talking about after 5 hours is kind of when our racing starts. So what we basically mean by that is in the first hour, the brake goes. So we race at a high intensity. It slows down like at 200, anything from 200 to 300 watts for the next hour. And then from there on, it just gradually increases. And we've seen it actually now with Rusty Woods. Training Peaks file, that every climb they just went a little bit faster, a little bit faster, until the final two, where they completely ripped it and they produced their best powers on the final climb, which tells you that. And to me, that represents exactly what World Tour is. It's nothing about producing those best powers in the first 3 hours. It's all about producing your best powers in the last hour of racing.
Yeah. Like if you analyze that file, they were climbing, they basically started climbing at like 5 watts a kilo, which, you know, to be honest, at World Tour level is nothing. Absolutely nothing. They increased it up and they went sort of 5.3 in the middle, got to around 5.8 for the last, and the last one, they, you know, looking at his files, he smashed sort of like 6.5 watts a kilo for that last climb after 250 odd k's, and which is, you know, it's impressive. It's like a pyramid going up, as opposed to when I try to do intervals, it's a pyramid going down. And like when you look at that, you know what, like, you know, you always get your, and I say this respectfully to like the local guys, that like you say, what are your goals when you take them on as coaching? And they're like, oh, I want to go to, like, I want to win world champs. And you're like, okay, well, you need to finish 100k race first. But they don't actually understand the level of what it is at that level. You know, it's yes, there's 200 guys racing, but it's 200 of the best in the world. Like, that is why they are there. You know, and then it gets whittled down to obviously three at the end. But, you know, to honestly smash 6.5 watts a kilo on that last climb at the end of the day it's impressive. I was really impressed by it all.
Yeah. And when we say this is like, you say it was whittled down to three, but the time gaps weren't really huge at all. And we need to
Sorry, four actually, because Dumoulin came back. Sorry about that.
We also need to take in consideration this is over 270 kilometers that it took them to, and it's between the world's best. But we also need to remember that not every the world champs is not the be all and end all. Not everyone specifically trained for this event. Imagine how crazy it would be if everyone prepped their year around just this. Because then it would be epic as well.
Yeah, then I'd almost say to you that...
Bunch sprint.
They would literally... Yeah, like, I'd be glad I wouldn't be racing, put it that way. But, like, you know, there again, I still also do believe it'll be whittled down, you know, to sort of your... that those, like, special finish. You know, like, maybe instead of four going to the line, there would be maybe eight. You know, something like that. Or maybe even four, because, you know, leading up to that kind of crucial point, that the wall that they did and the climb before that, where Dan Martin and them were off, was that, you know, instead of kind of cruising in inverted commas at like five and a half watts, they probably would have smashed 5.5, 6.
Yeah,
you know, and you do that over 3,500 meters, and you have 500 to go, and you know, it's a it'll be different, you know, because everyone's good, everyone's fresh, you know. Are there more attacks, you know? So your like dynamics and the race craft of that may differ, but you know, either way, it's glad I'm not there.
Yeah, it's almost like it would have kind of been like a Dubai type of effect, just, you know.
Yeah, 100%.
John,
like
then
it's sort of your strongest stays on until beaten, basically.
John, then, and I just quickly want to make a side note. Just seriously, did anyone think Peter Sagan was going to make it to the final? I saw some people say that. I was just like, I'm not being ugly or anything, but if you don't get it that he would never make it on a course like this by just looking at the preview, then unfortunately, I have to be very honest, but then you don't understand cycling. Because
had this conversation, and obviously you read some social media stuff, and I said the same thing. Someone was like, "Oh, it's a typical like brilliant classics course. It's this and that, like Sagan," and I think Sagan is phenomenal. Like, don't get me wrong, I think he's a phenomenal bike rider. But when you look at that, and you look at the distance, you look at the climbing, you look at the climbs, and that you were like. Like, no disrespect, but there was no chance. Like, absolutely. Like, if he had won, I would have. I don't know. I probably would have had to have eaten everything in my house and sold my house, like, to pay back debts. But there was no way. Like, I'm sorry to say, like, there was absolutely no chance.
If he had won, he would. I would rate him as the best cyclist to be ever. Because then it would have been four world championships in a row. And over a course of 5,500 meters of climbing, I just want to tell the people, go try and climb 3,000 meters, and not a rolling 3,000 meters. I mean, go climb 3,000 meters by doing one climb up, down, because that's basically worlds. It wasn't a rolling 3,000. It was basically up, down, up, down.
It was straight up and straight down. That's what it was.
Okay, John, then just to jump over to one of the questions someone asked, we talked about this earlier, the FTP versus 4DP. What me and John are trying to think here is, what do you actually want to know out of this? Because both represent information, but it puts it out differently. So, it's John, if you can just give us a short summary of what it actually is, and then... what would you think? I can't ask you what would you think would be best to use as training, because both are critical.
Definitely. So, maybe read out that question so the other people listening now can understand what the question was that came in exactly.
Okay, just hold on. Okay, so it says. Thanks for the podcast, guys. Enjoyed it. Just a question. I have recently read on the internet about FTP versus 4DP. Partly, it's type of a workout in a certain training app that shows your weak spots, etc. That training app is probably, like you mentioned, the Sufferfest.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so basically what the difference is in a FTP test essentially is just a functional threshold test. You know, like typically it's a 20-minute test and you get your threshold value off it, whether it's heart rate or power, and you use that as your training tool. So say you want to do 2-minute like anaerobic efforts, you would do that at say 120% of FTP and you'd get a value. You know, like whether 280 is your threshold and you're doing those at say 340. Where and that's your only value that you get from that. Where your 4DP essentially is four critical power values, being your 5 second, your 1 minute, your 5 minutes, which is typically your peak power value, and then also your 20 minute, which will give you your threshold value. You know, so you're looking at your anaerobic capacity, your neuromuscular power, your maximal aerobic effort, and obviously your functional threshold power. So you just get off that more kind of more values on what to work off, and it kind of tells you in inverted commas what type of rider you are. So if you have a really good 5 second power, you know, possibly you should be more headed towards like sprints or flat races, stuff like that. So it's just really another tool or another bunch of metrics that you can use to train off. You know, is one better than the other? No, I wouldn't say it is. It just really what works for you or what you want, essentially.
John,
You know, and where,
am I correct in saying that, okay, and I don't mean this ugly, but going from a complete amateur and then working your up by, let's say, a Cat 3, Cat 2, Cat 1 Continental Pro Conti World Tour. So you can kind of say, we can kind of say training, the normal training peaks is more than enough for you know, like let's say until Conti level or Pro Conti almost. But then WK04 gives you more information, but half of it we can't, you know, I never look at or use. Do you even use some of it then in regards with this?
Yeah, so I obviously use, as you know, your Training Peaks online to prescribe stuff, and then I do kind of all your analysis and that. And I've got certain charts in that in WK04. Of those charts, I probably use 8 of them. And then from that, I've obviously customized them myself. And then obviously, like one of them is kind of your critical power, being your 5 second, 1 minute, 5 minute, 20 minute, 6 minute, 60 minutes, and 10 minutes. Yeah, 10 minute kind of often people do ask me why do I have a 10 minute. It's just a value that I personally use to track progression and form in athletes. I don't know why. I can't give you the exact reason why, but it's something I've always done and I find very useful.
I guess it's
But yeah,
probably
it's
preferential to each coach, you know, some
yeah,
specific
100%.
stuff.
Like some guy could use 8 minutes, you know, and if that's great if he gets the data he needs out of that. You know, especially for South African racing itself, yeah, 10 minutes is for me is a very critical value. You know, for you, I've kind of obviously picked it up for some stuff, but I still use 10 minutes. But yeah, WKO has hundreds of charts. Like, I mean, these new guys are adding stuff every day and that. And I look at them and you kind of get a bit lot. Some of the charts are really good. I get lost in translation, even myself, in some of them. So I just kind of stick to what I know and what I've customized. And for me, it works. But there is a lot of stuff out there that sort of gets you lost in translation. You know, again, it's great to have all those metrics, but I don't like if you've got like an athlete page and it's got 400 charts on it.
It doesn't
I don't
make
know.
your riders
It
better
doesn't.
or your yeah, it
No,
does
it doesn't.
no. So that's
Like
very important.
be specific. Use stuff that you understand, that you know how to track, you know, etc. Whether that is whatever that is, but just less is more with more kind of personal touch and more information at the end of the day.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I think that summarizes it for the second episode of this vlog of this podcast. John, Thanks for the information and everything. And
Sure.
please remember, guys, to please ask us more questions. I know you ask me all on YouTube, but please leave them on the podcast section, because it's otherwise I have to go look up for all of them, and that makes it quite difficult. Awesome. Thanks, Joel.
Sure. And in closing, are you looking forward to the next 2 weeks of racing?
What's Munster Giro is a 200K
Yeah,
race. What, the day
that's
after
Wednesday.
tomorrow? I see Greipel is and Gaviria is gonna be there, so I think we'll probably be doing the work for Rick Zabel, Eric Zabel's son.
Yeah.
He's got quite a good turn of speed, so it's gonna be difficult for him because he's not as big as Greipel then, but yeah, he's got some really good speed, so I really believe he can get a podium.
Yeah, he's good. He's quick off the mark.
And then the
Cool.
big one, Lombardia, but yeah,
Yeah,
it's
and that's next week Saturday on the 13th. Sure. Yeah, that's it. I know, but then it's feet up and you can eat cookies and stuff. It'll be great.
But this that's actually that's it's it's like having to, you know how it goes. It's like you know how cycling is. You have to eat low carb on easy days, or low carb on rest days, and then high carb on a high on hard days, and then kind of a medium diet on medium days. So it's like, like sugar is addictive, but it's like more
Yeah.
easy when you just completely don't eat it, to leave it, than
Yeah,
go on and off
sure.
flip. But anyway, for
Yeah.
big off season, it's definitely time for cookies and cakes and even a beer or two.
Yeah. 100%.
Okay, John, I'm just stopping.